From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents part three of a discussion of the connections among citizenship, politics, and individual character, with special reference to the models in antiquity available to the American founders. The speakers are John Agresto, my colleague at the National Humanities Center, and two recent visitors at the center, Alvin Bernstein, a professor of classics at Cornell University, and Gene Yarborough, a political scientist from Loyola University in Chicago.
We've talked a little about the ancient view of character, and we've talked a good bit about the American character at present and certain modern critiques of American character. What would the ancients say? Were they able to view Americans? What would they say about this man, the American, these people, the Americans?
Let me see if I can put both parts of your question together and answer them with one answer. I think the thing that would shock them the most would be the educational system, particularly the early educational system and the direction in which it's moving. They believed, as I suggested earlier, that character was to a large part fixed by disposition, and that had to do with whether you were born well. But after that, in the early years, education consisted in building character. And what a good Roman aristocrat would do would be to strive, to the extent that it was possible, to keep his son away from any potentially corrupting forces, so that he wouldn't see evil, so that he wouldn't see wickedness, so that he wouldn't see injustice, because that was how he was going to produce a good man. And I think that, you know, if Cicero were walking around today in his toga, he would be appalled at the phenomenon of taking very young people and putting them into a environment over which the parents had no control whatsoever, to actually put him into that world where the parents might even freely admit that he was going to, at an early age, come into contact with ugliness, come into contact with things that they didn't want to see him anywhere near, those corrupting forces. And I think that that's probably where they would find us least comprehensible. For us, education is the inculcation of certain technical skills. As I say,
for them it was values, morals.
For them it was values, morals, and the things that you needed to have, you know, to have the proper values and morals and put them into action. So, for example, they would have put, I think, courage very high on the list of what they were trying to inculcate into their sons. I keep using the word sons because they were much more concerned with the education of sons than they were with daughters, because sons were public people. And so they would, as I say, they would keep them close. And the technical education to read, to write, to know how the Roman Senate worked, to understand politics, all these things would be of secondary importance. They could do that by letting them literally sit by the Senate House door and observe things. Or the father literally would go out and teach his son how to fight in armor and to do things like this. But most of it was literally just sort of keeping him close and watch and allowing him to observe the family. The family was very strong, as you know, in antiquity, and it wasn't the weak, fragile nuclear family of modernity, but it was a much more extended family, so that you could pass the child around. And again, in the Roman Republican period, families were known for having dispositional types. I mean, those people were known to be extraordinarily proud. These people were arrogant. This was a particularly courageous family. You could trust these people to hold a hostage because you knew that their sense of honor was so great that if you tried to transgress them, you would begin a blood vendetta. And as I say, it was, and the formal education was inculcation into family lore, L-O-R-E, you know. They would constantly tell you what it is that your ancestors had done. In fact, they had public ceremonies to this effect. The funeral was a wonderful example of this. What they would do is they would take the body of the deceased, carrying it in an upright position, and then there would be actors or descendants who would follow and train with these masks of all the people who had ever been in the family who had held public office, wearing the robes appropriate to the highest offices that they had held, and then they would sort of march in this funeral procession, and then there would be a recitation of everything that each one of these people had done. In fact, this Greek Polybius, who the founding fathers very very happy to read, actually said the Romans, for more than any other reason, the Romans were able to achieve what they were able to achieve through this kind of education, through these expectations that were then passed along to the sons of the Roman aristocracy.
So you don't really divorce the family from education, yet when you have your Cicero walking around the streets, you talk more about the educational system. What would he say about our families?
What would Cicero say about our families?
Yeah.
He would say that they're being killed by social mobility, by physical mobility. I think his first view would be that the family is not meant to move around as much as it is. He would sort of be shocked at how we've deprived ourselves of the support systems that keep the family together. He would also, for example, I think he would be very surprised at the concept of romantic love and how far we take it. Families were arranged in antiquity. I mean, it was perfectly all right to feel the passions, but one oughtn't to go quite so far as to allow that to determine the future, or at least not the very long distance future. You were meant to make proper alliances, and then, as I say, all these support systems would come into play, and so that if anything happened to your husband, there would be a brother-in-law or a paterfamilias. And I think, again, that the thing that would perplex him the most would be the breakdown of that unit, which is what sustained life, and in a way what made life worth living, because you had these fixed values. They were very, very definite. They were expectations, and they showed you how to behave.
To a large extent so far, we've been focusing on the individual and saying these are the institutions that sustain character, the church, education, the family. But it occurs to me that in some way, if we come back to the question of the family for a moment, and here Tocqueville comes to mind, and Tocqueville's argument that perhaps it is the women that the women inculcate virtue, as he says, they're the keepers of the moral. So that, in fact, if it's true that one needs a strong sense of family life, that only half the population can be free because the other half have to be home preparing them for that freedom. That in some Which is a problem.
It is a problem, but it wouldn't have been a problem for the Romans, for a variety of reasons. One thing, I think a Roman woman, whether rightly or wrongly, we can debate that, would have seen her role as being satisfactory. Satisfactory because it was so important. And the Romans in this respect were much different from the Greeks. The Romans refused to use wet nurses. The child was always looked after by the mother herself, and as sort of Mediterranean families do today, the grandmother was always a very important figure in the early stages of development. Now, the truth is that the Roman woman doesn't speak for herself very well, particularly in the Republic, where she's hidden from sight. But as I say, I would infer that there were no problems along these lines. When we see the Roman women at work, it's when the Republic is disintegrating, and then during the Empire, because imperial politics are family politics. And then, of course, you have to know very little Roman history indeed to know how important the wife mother figures were in determining the course of the Roman Empire. You know, I mean, to the extent that Nero eventually gets so upset with his mother that he decides he has to literally physically remove her from the face of the earth. But what one can infer back, I think, that in matters of forming policy, of giving direction to family decisions and even political decisions, we do get glimpses of women directing this enormously.
I think, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that it's not a problem as long as the Republic defines its chief principle is that of virtue, because then men can have their virtues and women can have their virtues. But it becomes more difficult when you define a republic in terms of liberty, because then the question becomes, well, even if one were to make the distinction between men and women, what's the basis upon which you deny women the liberty that you deny men, since the principle is liberty and not virtue? Yet the paradox is that intelligent or well-exercised liberty depends upon virtue.
It's difficult to know how the Romans would respond to that. I mean, the first thing, of course, is the word virtue. Virtus comes from the Latin vir. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, virtue is literally manliness. I think if they were going to try to defend their position, They would defend it along the following lines. First, they would point out to you that at the heart of their political institutions were their military institutions. In fact, their military institutions were simply a reflection. I mean, their political institutions were simply a reflection of the army, and indeed that's where it came from. And I think they might begin to talk in terms of rights and responsibilities. In other words, what did the assembly do? Well, in the end, what the assembly did was either decide to go to war or not to go to war, or to choose the people who would make this decision. I mean, if you look at the Republic for the last, well, let's say roughly for the last 275 years of its existence, it's at war for every year except 12 years. And in a society like that, it's not entirely surprising that you're not giving an enormous amount of civic freedom to your women, simply because in some sense they're not sharing the responsibilities.
I want to go back. We've talked a good bit about what formed, especially Roman character, but I'm not sure I'm clear on what Roman character was like. What would it be like to have a Roman as a friend?
Within the limits of individuality, he would be probably much more loyal. Again, because Roman society was at heart a kind of a society of patron-client relationships, where fides, where loyalty is what gave the future predictability. It was very important that I should be able to trust you to help me when I got in trouble, to get a barrister for me if I found myself in a law court, to lend me your ox if mine suddenly dropped dead. I think that probably, again, it's also much more predictable society throughout. Power, I think, was much more visible in ancient society than it is in modern America. And when you know who has power, and you also know that people with power are meant to exercise it either on your behalf or to your detriment, then I think relationships are much surer, and the etiquette of relationships is much more stylized. If you really understood that you owed probably your existence to me, then I think you would be very deferential in everything that you did to me. You know, you take a kind of a silly analogy. If you were my undergraduate student and you understood that the letter of recommendation that I wrote for you was a personal affair, and that letter was going to determine your career, then I think you would be very reluctant to misbehave in class or to presume upon you using my first name. I think the second thing would be that you would then also see the entire action as assuming an obligation, so that, you know, at the appropriate moment I could call upon you to look after the appropriate part of my anatomy when I finally did get you into medical school and you grew up to be the doctor that you were trying to be.
Well, if the state was the focal point for the Roman citizen, if that was crucial to Roman character, what's crucial to American character?
Well, if self-interest is written into the into the Constitution as the thing that's going to make everything else go, then and self-interest can so easily deteriorate into a kind of material self-interest, then I think that the first thing is that the Romans, in that respect, had it all over us. And I suppose the second thing, which has nothing to do with the framing of the Constitution, is we don't have that long tradition, which the Romans could sort of call upon, which went back to recorded memory of, well, not quite recorded memory, but certainly into the 8th century
I would just disagree in one sense, or rather add a clarification, and that is, I think in one instance you talk about the end to which Rome is dedicated, and in the other one you talk about the motive or the spring which holds us together, and I think that they're not analogous. So that I think I would say that individual liberty, as each one of us defines it, however well or however poorly, or a commitment to being free, to doing our own thing, as everyone says, that if anything holds us together, if anyone thinks that's what America is, I would say that it's more that than self-interest, though self-interest is the means by which we do whatever it is we think we ought to do.
Yes, well, however you want to phrase that. You know, one of the famous stories, and that is of course Dido and Aeneas, And for whichever reason, I mean, Aeneas has to leave Dido because he's got a destiny. And the contemporary Aeneas, I think, for whatever reasons, might have dallied a little bit longer, whether out of self-interest or out of simply wanting to do his own thing again.
Well, we've trivialized that you find that in Western movies now, where the guy rides off and does what he has to do. But people go to that, and that's merely entertainment. Or do they take
it
seriously?
But it's an ideal. I mean, it can be an ideal. It can be that the negation of that is just simply unacceptable behavior. That doesn't mean people don't behave unacceptably. It means that if they behave that way, they pay a certain price, certainly in shame and perhaps a little bit in guilt. And I think that is a difference between us and them. I mean, if you say to people long enough, do your own thing, that's what you're meant to be doing, you create a different sort of person than if you create a person to whom you say you have obligations which sometimes require that you deny the demands of self.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about politics and character, as this connection extends from antiquity to the time of the American founders and into the present day. The speakers are my colleague John Agresto and two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, Alvin Bernstein, a professor of classics at Cornell University, and Jean Yarborough, a political scientist from Loyola University in Chicago.
Let's pick up on that, the very idea of a different sort of person. I mean, we know what the modern platitudes are about, you know, everybody is the same, it's a small world, people are the same all over the world, and yet you're coming to here and telling us that, in fact, Roman citizens were different, as you put it, sorts of people.
Yes. They had certain values, certain very, very fixed values that they were meant to live up to. And these values, I think actually the heart of the value of those values was even more than the state, was the family itself. And they were, whether they were self-deceived or not, whether underneath it all they were exactly like we are, whether they had the same needs, wants, and desires, whether, you know, the reality was such that enormous pressures were brought to bear for them to act in socially approved of and prescribed ways. And so you were living in a society where, first of all, there were these expectations, and they were made very, very clear. And there was a good deal of public disapproval if in any way, shape, size, or form you transgressed these expectations. You disgraced the family. You humiliated the family. You behaved very badly on the battlefield, and you became anathema to the people who cared most about you and who in some sense made your life worth living. And so I think that given that there were these hard expectations for people like this, that there were prescribed actions, prescribed descriptions of how you were meant to behave, they were different from us. We allow much greater latitude. I think we allow about as much latitude as you can possibly conceive of, by and large. And I think that makes for a different person. Again, to put it in gross language, they probably, in comparison with, were very self-disciplined people. There was a sense that the will must work, and the will must work on behalf of other, whether other was, were other people or outside principles. And it seems to me that we don't put this emphasis on.
If it's true, then, that the political institutions in some way depend, they, while political institutions help shape the character of citizens, in some ways they depend on the character of those citizens for their perpetuation and for their continuation, then we get a problem. If, in fact, if the current opinions are true, or some current sociological opinions are true, that there's been a decline or some kind of corruption in the family, in education, and certainly a decline in religion, what does that mean for American moral character, and ultimately what does that mean for the continuation of the American Republic? I mean, can we be so blunt about it? Does a decline in morality and character mean a decline in politics, this constitutional structure, in this republic?
I'm not optimistic.
Why not?
Let me start. I think the purpose, whereas the founders believed that it was absolutely essential to have an educated citizen body, they didn't mean that everyone should have a PhD. Jefferson thought that they should go to the third grade and then you would have the annual raking from the rubbish. But by the time they had a minimal education, the point of that education was to make them citizens, that they would be instructed in ancient Greek and Roman history so that they could see how their liberties were won and lost. And that political education would continue up through the university level, and so that they could be better statesmen. That was primarily the purpose of education, to prepare people for citizenship. If you contrast that with the views today, as if somehow teaching citizenship is not an appropriate function of the schools, that it's equated with propaganda, that we are teaching that somehow it's appropriate to talk about values, but we're not actually allowed or expected to hold any, and we're certainly not expected to be able to defend any of them. I think that one of the ways in which the purpose of American education has simply changed. It's changed, and perhaps it placed too great an emphasis upon preparing people simply for citizenship. But increasingly throughout the 19th century and in our own century, the purpose of education is essentially to secure good jobs for people. And it becomes a vehicle by which one moves out of the class in which one is born. And this has very little, I think, to do with citizenship. I'm certainly not about to fall to working mothers, but I think that the rise in single-parent families, the rise in children, the rise in the number of children born out of wedlock, I think the abdication of family responsibility for teaching some kind of morals, the great pressure of peer groups, and television is the center of family life, that there's no activity in which a parent and child can join together save for watching a television show at 7 o'clock on Wednesday night. That these things in a way all tend to the weakening, if not the dissolution of any form of character, and what replaces it is simply a kind of stimulus response, but there's nothing from within anymore. But that the question of character suggests that there's something within us, and I think the forces that mold the family today are largely external, that we respond to outside forces at earlier and earlier ages. Children become products of or become responsive to the pressures of their peer group rather than in the notion that parents ought to have any say in the lives of their children, that we get once again a sort of perversion of the American emphasis upon rights by talking about the rights of children vis-a-vis their parents, as if we are to assume that every parent is a child abuser or something like that, against which a child may make legitimate claims. I think all those things weaken the question of character.
If that's true, there seems to be a strange paradox involved here. If, in fact, the liberties of the nation depend upon a certain inculcation of character, yet those institutions that inculcate that character seem to be, in some ways, eroded by the very practice of a certain kind of liberty. I mean, just take off some of the things you mentioned. An interest, a very private personal interest in jobs, as opposed to civic duty. The rise of single-parent families, the rise in divorce rate, the weakening of the moral authority of teachers, religious leaders, families, the rise in the idea of children's rights. All of those things at least have some basis, some ground in the belief in at least perhaps some kind of belief in private right, liberty, doing one's own thing. So the ground that protects liberty, namely a certain kind of character, is eroded by a certain practice of that liberty.
Well, if education originally, if I read you right, was intended to produce something besides the commercial ethic, what was it?
The civic ethic. I mean, I don't presume to speak for you, but if I understand what you're saying, it's that there's nothing wrong with the university preparing someone for a job. It's when I walk into the classroom and I make a moral statement, and that is universally perceived as being somehow illegitimate, that you have to worry very much about the educational
system.
Who
are you to tell me that?
Well, precisely. And I think one of the things that happened to us fairly recently was that there was a moment when civics, both in the university and before it, was legitimate, because there were certain assumptions about the quality of American life which were universally held. And there was that moment at which the country became perceived by increasing numbers of students as being in itself bad. And so it became very difficult even to try to explain the structure in any sympathetic way, because now you were again engaged in the process of making value judgments, and in point of fact, paradoxically enough, you were making bad moral evaluations. That is to say, you were saying something was good when it was not. It was an interesting argument advanced by the radicals in the late 60s and early 70s when they began to ask for courses which didn't educate but educated to, ironically enough. And educated to was a phrase that meant to raise the consciousness to the higher realities of radical political thought. And when the professoriate replied, no, that's not right, we don't engage in indoctrination, then we were hoist with our own liberal petard saying, but of course you do. I mean, you every day you teach us what a fine, wonderful country this is and how intelligent the founding fathers were and what a great constitutional structure it is. And I think if you want to be pessimistic, I think it's perfectly reasonable to be pessimistic about an educational philosophy which prohibits people from making positive judgments about the very structure which sustains the university, the very governmental structure which sustains the university. And I think that's something that the founding fathers would not have anticipated. I think that's a whole series, a whole train of events, which would be very, very difficult for me to imagine that they had foreseen.
Yes, in two respects. One is that they started from the foundation of natural rights, and those things were absolute in one sense, and not rights were not whatever we wanted them to be, or we had a fairly firm understanding of what we meant by them. Nevertheless, in trying to put those natural rights into practice, there is a way in which the logic of liberty, which insists or feeds on itself, and which says this liberty must have that liberty and that liberty must have still another liberty. So I think that there, in that sense, it's absolute. We have the natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which somehow that whole notion that we share common commitments is later eroded by the rejection of natural rights, because that somehow implies a human nature, and that's too coercive or oppressive or repressive, or what does that mean for X number of particular groups within society? And then we gradually move away from that and begin to define rights as whatever we think are fundamentally important at a particular time. And this, again, there's a sort of logic then where increasingly one liberty seems to need another, to need another, to need another. And I think we arrive at this position where we're somehow unwilling to say that any liberty ought not to be allowed because it's perverse. Jefferson's opposition to free speech is very well known. I think questions of pornography, for example, everyone agreed that those things were not desirable, and there wasn't. I don't think it raised a serious.
In contrast to the "I'm okay, you're okay"
exactly.
kind of thing, anything goes.
Yeah, one of the things that's happened is that we've lost a sort. I think we really. I'm not sure of the extent to which we believe in the Declaration of Independence anymore.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The Center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for the third part in a series of discussions about politics and the American character. What models in antiquity did the American founders look to? How did social institutions such as religion, the family, and education in ancient Rome and Greece influence notions of character and citizenship in the minds of the American founders? A panel of scholars at the National Humanities Center has some insights and answers. Politics and the American Character, Part 3. Listen this week for Soundings.